Good evening, everyone. As per usual, I'm Craig Eastman, coming to you from the banks of the beautiful River Mersey. That's beautiful in the loosest sense of the word. And in Glasgow, as always, is Scott Morris.
Howdy.
And in Brighton's in Falkirk, we are, as always, joined by the mighty Drew Tavendale.
Howdy.
We've got a cinematic menagerie to explore tonight. And so without further ado, we're going to get on with the show. Hey-ho, let's go. When a Russian immigrant smuggled into a crumbling future America turns out to be host to an organism which a twisted religious cult hopes to gather in order to genetically engineer an embodiment of their figure of worship, there's only one man who can help. Unfortunately, he was busy, so director Matthew Kasovitz got Don the Blower to Vin Diesel instead. Scott is going to explain to us exactly why, at a time when oil prices are skyrocketing, the value of diesel is so low.
Oh, it's a bit harsh. I mean, this is a bad film, but it sort of chronicles a Riddick bad. It's not The Pacifier bad. I would normally start by explaining what goes on in a film, but I'm rather stymied in Babylon AD because I still don't have the vaguest concept of what's really supposed to be happening in this film.
Could it be down to the lead man's incomprehensible mumblings?
It is sadly nothing to do with that. It's just a complete lack of any sort of exposition whatsoever. And on the very basic, superficial level, it is simply a chase movie, as per umpteen other ones that we've seen set in some post-apocalyptic rundown state that sort of comes across as a cross between, I don't know, Blade Runner and Escape from New York or something. And on that level, it's sort of okay. It suffers rather badly from wanting to be incredibly violent and being completely constrained by being a 12A. So as this very uneasy tone of wanting to be really bleak, miserable and violent and also being rather family friendly, which doesn't work in the slightest. So it's a sort of middling action film on that level. There's some interesting concepts underlining it, but exactly what they are is kind of difficult to say. The book that it's based on appears to be even more abstracted than this film interpretation of it, which already does a fairly poor job of explaining what it does. The exposition that is there is typically inserted in clumsy blocks that just feel out of place, and they often wind up obscuring a lot more than they actually explain. And by the end of it, it's become so bafflingly high concept that it's quite difficult to actually care about any of it, and certainly the last 10 minutes are entirely baffling, and what it was supposed to be saying about anything is something of a mystery. There's rumours abound of some sort of director's cut coming out fairly soon that will, on DVD, which might clear up a lot of this and restore some of the original vision or whatever they want to put on it, which, as long as it has some sort of flowchart explaining what's going on, I'll be happy. So it's
a diesel flowchart.
It's not a bad film. It's reasonably, at least, entertaining to sort of sit through for 2 hours, but it's certainly not something I can recommend on much of a level.
Is it actually attempting to do anything new with the genre, Drew, or is it just an incomprehensible pile of psychobabble?
I don't think I found it quite as baffling as Scott, but yeah, it needs some exposition. As for trying to do anything new with the genre, no, but very few films ever have managed to do that, have they? And it's a chase film, there's not an awful lot you can change with that.
I'm not particularly familiar with the source material, but I am unfortunately familiar with Vin Diesel's canon of work. I mean, where does this rate in the overall Vin Diesel-o-graph?
Yeah, that's the thing, Vin Diesel isn't actually that bad in it. I mean, he manages to actually have some charisma. You do, to some degree, have some interest in the outcome of his character, which is one step above what he normally manages.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think if the exposition had been a bit better, then it might have been one of the better Vin Diesel films without him ruining it, either.
It still actually is one of the best Vin Diesel films. This is not something to brag about.
To say it's not that great, but it's not that bad, isn't it? You know, you could apply that to the vast majority of stuff coming out at the moment, so
yes,
does this do anything at all to distinguish itself from the pack? Or,
I suppose it does, in that it's it is trying to have a story in this chase film that's sort of, you know, it's trying to do something different. It's just that it fails, I guess, because it is so incomprehensible, and the only bit of exposition is an incredibly clunky bit sort of stuck in that still doesn't go anything like far enough anyhow.
Well, that's not fair. There's two incredibly clunky bits that are stuck in, and neither of which actually help explaining what any of the subplots are supposed to be about. Something vaguely to do with manufactured religions, I'm not entirely sure what, and two babies that may or may not be the second coming of Jesus. I don't really know, but there's two kids at the end of it, so that means something to somebody.
Fair enough. It doesn't seem to be meaning much to the box office at the moment, is it? Because it's hardly ringing the cash registers.
No, it is something of an acquired taste. It's one of these films. The main problem I've got with it is that it really just doesn't find its tone properly. It desperately is trying to be something, you know, really gritty and violent, and it can't be because it's a 12A.
And that's something we've been discussing in a lot of films recently too, that there actually needing to be a higher rating to do it justice.
Yeah. I mean, Matthew Kasowitz is an interesting figure, really, isn't he? I mean, he garnered huge praise for Lehane back in 1995, which people were saying was a wake-up call to urban France and all this sort of jazz, and it won numerous awards. And since then, he's given us Assassins and Gothica, both of which go quite some way to undermining his initial promise. But he's one of these faces that turns up in a lot of films that people probably recognise from foreign cinema, but they're not entirely au fait with the name. Can't think what I was actually trying to say by raising that point. Never mind. Babylon AD, probably safe to say then, guys, not exactly worth hauling your ass off the sofa to go and see if you're not already heading down to the cinema then.
I'd say not, no.
Guillermo del Toro's standard one for me, one for the studio model, coughs up the latter in the form of Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, a sequel to his original 2004 comic book adaptation Hellboy. Once again charting the antics of the Bureau for Paranormal Research and Defence, Hellboy 2 focuses on a long-forgotten truce between humans and elves, which is threatened when former Bros frontman Luke Goss, an exiled elf prince no less, decides to give his old man the stabby-stabby treatment and awaken the titular army of all-powerful mechanical fiends in the hopes of giving mankind a bit of a kicking. Ron Perlman returns as Hellboy, and this time, as well as fighting off insanely large monsters, he finds his relationship with fellow agent and lover Liz, Selma Blair, at a stretch as he attempts to garner the public recognition he craves and his colleagues desperately want to avoid. Can Big Red save the day and keep the girl, or will he be heading back to hell in a CG handcart? Now, I haven't seen the original Hellboy. I keep meaning to sort of catch up with it, so I'm not entirely sure what events have transpired before, but it certainly strikes me as being quite a strange premise. I have seen reviews of Hellboy 2 which are saying it's possibly the best sort of film of its type of the summer, but I'm at a bit of a loss. There are elements of it which please me, and there are elements of it which I find leave me wanting, and it's not often that I will come into a big budget sequel to a summer sort of action flick and not necessarily understand where the characters have come from, and I'm not entirely sure if it's a mark of Del Termo's quality of writing that he seems interested in moving on with the plot from the first film without much recap, and the characters' backstories aren't given any sort of recap or anything like that, or whether he just has attention deficit disorder or something, because it seems to stumble on from one CG set piece to another. Scott, what was your overall opinion?
Well, I did quite like this film. It's certainly enjoyable enough. The only problem I've really got with it, I'm not sure where you're coming from, the character stuff. If you've missed the origin story, then I suppose that you're perhaps at a bit of a loss to explain why this big red fella is stomping about helping humans for no particularly good reason, but that's why it's explained. Well, perhaps not explained, but it keeps coming back to that in the film, of what side this should this big red machine be on. The main problem I've got with it is simply the CG, not the quality of the CG, which is about as good as anything else. It's just the simple fact that it's stopped being a spectacle an awfully long time ago. In this day and age, where pretty much every advert break has, you know, CG on a par with anything you find in a cinema, I'm really not impressed by big CG set pieces anymore. So, like, towards the end, when this big giant thing comes out of the earth, as the when they're in Ireland towards the end, which should by rights be jaw-droppingly spectacular, it just turns out to be something that I've seen umpteen times before and will see umpteen times again.
The big stone gateway monster thing.
Yeah, and it's sad because there are parts of it that are very special. I think Del Toro has a pretty good answer to most of it, because when they go into that Trolls Market, which is, okay, there's CG there, but largely it's just people in suits wandering about.
Yeah,
and
it's
that
very
does,
well done.
It looks very special. It looks completely unlike anything that I've seen in the last 18 years, apart possibly from Hellboy 1. And if they kept up doing things like that, it would have been something different and something special and would have been a lot better. But by the time it gets to the end and Hellboy is taking on the Golden Army and it's devolved into more CG pixels, bathing other CG pixels, you could be watching the Hulk or any one of 100 other superhero-y type films, and it's completely interchangeable with everything else. That, more than anything else, annoys me about Hellboy 2. There are moments where it does seem to go across into being something special, and then it gets pulled back into this morass of CG along with everything else in the world.
Yeah, it's frustrating because I know we, throughout the sort of the review team, we have varying opinions on Pan's Labyrinth. But regardless of what you think of it, I think it's safe to say that Pan's Labyrinth uses CG in quite a restrained and, as a result, a much more effective way than this, which just seems to be... And like you say, I mean, I can't really find fault with the quality of the CG, because it seems to be one thing that Del Toro does really well, is that sort of that rough-looking, sort of dirty, gritty kind of chunky machinery and sort of crumbling stone look, but it's just thrown about with such abandon that, like you say, I mean, from CG set piece to CG set piece, I didn't find myself sort of sitting back and all thinking, oh, that looks cool. It was just a pixel bashing fest. Drew, what are your thoughts on the issue?
I feel the same. I just feel so very, very fed up of CGI. It just feels so very tawdry nowadays. And what I liked about this, and I had been looking forward to from the trailers, had been simply that some of it clearly wasn't CG, it was like using craft to use animatronics and just people in well-crafted suits. And the fact that the design of it, like Pan's Labyrinth, is pretty much unlike anything else you're likely to see in a cinema. But yeah, just once again, it's hamstrung itself by having its climactic battles being fully CGI-based, and it's just almost impossible to care.
I think it speaks volumes that I've heard a few of this from a few other people as well, but the one scene that everyone remembers more than anything else, with possible exception of that troll market that I spoke about, is the scene where Abe and Hellboy get drunk and start singing, which is no CG anywhere.
It's almost worth entry for that, yeah. It pains me to say this, but I get fed up of sort of films that just... It makes me feel like a hypocrite, because I hate sort of the films where you wander into a sequel and they feel they need to sort of spend 20 minutes on the backstory and re-explaining everything, and they drop clues here and there. And I always crave something that just that takes for granted that you'll probably have seen the first one. And now that Hellboy 2's come along, it's done exactly that to me. But whereas I was actually quite looking forward to the first film now on its reputation, I've watched this and it kind of actually put me off wanting to catch up with it. I mean, is that a reasonable thought, or should I, if anyone finds themselves in my position, should they still give the first film a chance?
I wouldn't rush out and do it.
No.
And I really, really disliked the first one, and then I watched it again before seeing Hellboy 2, and I liked it better. I didn't find myself quite as bored or irritated by it, but nothing much happens, and it still isn't that great a film, so I don't really think there's an awful lot of point in you seeking out the first one to watch, or anybody who hasn't seen the first one.
Scott, would you concur with that?
Hard to say. I mean, I didn't mind the first one all that much. Certainly, I think the second film is a lot better than the first film. But I can kind of see where you're coming from. If you're something like Spider-Man, you're something that is so ingrained in pop culture, you can kind of get away with not bothering to explain, oh, you got bitten by a radioactive spider. But Hellboy's a little bit more esoteric. It's just that little bit more strange. Could perhaps have done with a little bit more of an exposition there. I suppose it does make some kind of sop to it in the start when he's being told the plot in that storybook form, which incidentally is another nice little scene, animation on that. But yeah, I wouldn't actually rush out to watch the first film again.
I did find Johan Kraus quite funny.
True that.
There we go. Scant recommendation. One character was a mild giggle.
Well, it's perhaps been unnecessarily negative. I did quite like Hellboy 2. I still think it's actually worth going to see, but I just can't bring myself to be that excited about it. But I recognise
it's one of those instances where I can't necessarily fault it all that much, but I find myself sort of not really able to recommend it to anyone. It's caught in that strange state of flux, some strange alternate dimension between good and terrible. Ben X is a film from the Netherlands, from first-time director Nick Balthazar, and also first-time lead man Greg Timmermans, in which an autistic teenager decides that being bullied at school isn't the way to go, and instead immerses himself in the world of online role-playing games. Now, Scott, neither Drew or I have seen Ben X. Would it be worth our while catching up with it?
To be honest, no. It is one of the few films out of Belgium, so I suppose it's worth watching for that if you just like Belgium. But
has it got chocolate in it?
No.
Ah.
The problem I had with Ben X is that, for the most part, it is it's trying desperately to be a study in teenage disaffection, and Ben is getting bullied in the real world quite heavily, and that is effectively where it's coming from. He's bullied because he is very different. It's at the start of the film, and until about halfway through it, it is just seen as though he's incredibly antisocial and has the social skills of an orange and is retreated into a mamorphpiga. And the problem that it's got is that it's only about halfway through until it actually says, oh, by the way, he's actually autistic. He has Asperger's syndrome. And quite why they decided to bury that fact, because up until that point, the only impression you get of Ben is that he's a bit of a dick. And at least this provides some kind of mitigating factor for why he's being so completely pathetic.
But is it not in that case then challenging your perception of the character initially? Is it not placing you amongst the bullies who just don't understand Ben?
Not really, no.
Oh.
It's not like the bullies don't know that he's not got Asperger's. The whole point of it seems to be somewhat of a mystery. There is some plots where he's trying to be cheered up by his online best friend, and he gets caught up in these sort of increasingly frequent fantasies. It's told in a way that it keeps sort of intercutting footage of this computer game, though he keeps sort of envisaging the things that are going on around him as sort of translated into the kind of game form. And it has some mildly interesting visual tricks to it, but when you sort of sit at the end of it, you kind of wonder what the point of it was. It seems to be that bullying is bad, and I think most of us had probably already figured that one out. The other slight problem we got with it is that it does seem that all the actors in here are about 20-odd and acting as though they're 12. And, you know, it's like they're at a school for 12-year-olds that just apparently these actors are 20 for some reason, and it just seems very odd. The two lead bullies are acting in such ludicrously immature fashion that it completely undermines the fact that they're quite clearly visibly, I don't know, 18, 19, 20, something like that, but they're acting like 12-year-olds, and no one I know has ever acted like that once they get past a certain amount. You know, at some point, some kind of maturity kicks in, you stop being such a juvenile prick about things, and these guys don't.
And then you get your first sort of adult faculty.
Yeah, and it just undermined the whole thing. It just left it feeling somewhat silly, and couple that with the fact that it doesn't seem to have any particularly useful point. Bullying is bad, and yes, we all did know that, so I'm kind of left wondering exactly what I'm supposed to be taking away from it. I mean, there's a 5-minute sequence in Summerstown which deals with childhood bullying far more effectively than this does in 90 odd minutes of it. It's pretty much entirely avoidable unless you like Belgian films.
Imagine the sheer dismay of Drew and I when we realise that the only Belgian film made this century isn't even worth watching.
That's not true. We saw one during the festival.
Left Bank, that was Belgian, wasn't it?
It also was Dick.
Yes.
Damn those Belgians. Stick to the chocolate, boys. Based on one of the slightly more obscure 60s spy comedy series, Get Smart bills itself as wacky yet safe family spy fun. Steve Carell stars as bumbling control agent Maxwell Smart, and Anne Hathaway as Agent 99, his more adept sidekick. Together they attempt to thwart the nefarious schemes of evil organisation Chaos, that's K-A-O-S, who are no doubt planning to swap the planet with contrived acronyms. Drew is going to tell us more.
I will indeed. It's that films based on TV programmes are one of those four big Hollywood staples now, the others being the comic book movie, the sequel and the remake, that seem to make up the vast majority of the USA's film output. But The Simpsons movie aside, it seems, at least to me, as far as I can recall, to have been far less prevalent of late, and so therefore films based on TV programmes are consequently fresher and far more welcome than yet another superhero film would be. And fortunately, it's quite a good one too. As you said, Steve Carell is Maxwell Smart, an analyst for the CIA Light Control, a clandestine organisation locked in an eternal struggle with the evil acronym creating Chaos since the Cold War. After an attack on Control's headquarters leaves their numbers severely depleted, Max is promoted to field agent and must team up with Anne Hathaway's Agent 99 to investigate Chaos and discover the mole in their own organisation. There's not a lot more to it than that. I mean, as you can imagine, there's nothing spectacularly original about any of this, and it invites obvious comparisons with the likes of I Spy, against which it fares better, and the daddy of all spy spoofs, the Austin Powers films, which, Goldmember aside, it simply can't compete with. But that's no reason not to see it, as this has plenty of merits of its own. Though I've always considered his abilities far better suited to the wit and humour of the likes of Little Miss Sunshine and Dan in Real Life than the broad comedy of films like this, Carell is fortunately still very funny in Get Smart, unlike the mess that was Evan Almighty, and we can all be thankful for that. Snappy if unspectacular writing and a strong supporting cast, including Gurning Greeks, monosyllabic giant, the ever-excellent Alan Arkin as Control's boss, and sadly underused Dwayne Johnson, not to mention the ever-awesome Bill Murray in a tree, helped to keep the laughs coming fairly regularly. Sadly, the film is somewhat let down by Carell's co-star Hathaway. Not that Anne Hathaway is particularly bad, or performance is at the least entirely adequate, but there seems little chemistry between her and Carell, and she just seems to utterly lack charisma, making her character hard to care about, which is a bit of a problem given how much screen time she has. Still though, it whips along quite quickly, the laughs never let up much, and it's a pretty enjoyable way to spend 110 minute running time, so I would recommend it.
And Scott, would you be in recommendation as well?
Pretty much. A few minor issues with it. Why does Max Smart go from one scene he'll be so klutzy that he ought to be done by Leslie Nielsen rather than Steve Carell, and then in the same, the very next second, he'll suddenly be like a top marksman, being able to be an incredibly competent agent and being a completely incompetent agent, often in the same scene, which just seems a bit weird. Secondly, fat suits. Not funny, never have been funny, please stop using them. This aside, it's pretty good. I don't have an awful lot to say about it. It's pretty amusing and it's worth seeing.
Was it worthwhile digging up out of the 60s? Or?
Not in as much as that you couldn't do exactly the same thing with any other sort of contrived acronyms you like. I have no, apart from the one scene where it uses the shoe phone, it doesn't seem to have any particular relation to the old Get Smart, so quite why it was felt that it was needed to be brought back, I'm not entirely sure. But, well, why the hell not?
Oh, exactly.
If you're going to remake everything with a complete lack of unoriginality, at least it's well done and it's funny, so it's better than a lot of them.
Why don't they just remake Hollywood? Why don't they build another Hollywood right next to the old one and just move everything there? It'd be the logical conclusion.
Don't give them ideas.
Director Jonathan Levine was last seen on these shores garnering mixed reviews for his horror outing All the Boys Love Mandy Lane. Ditching psycho killers in favour of psychoanalysis, Levine returns with the far more satisfying The Whackness, the tale of young dope-dealing school kid Luke Shapiro, played by Josh Peck of TV's Drake and Josh fame, who struggles to find acceptance within his peers and is buffeted by the effects of his parents' brittle marriage. One of his best customers happens to be Dr. Squires, played by Ben Kingsley, a frequently tripping shrink who also happens to be the stepfather of Luke's crush Stephanie. As Squire struggles to reconcile his own failing marriage with his increasingly bizarre behaviour in a spaced-out midlife crisis, he also attempts to offer Luke somewhat hypocritical guidance in the hope that he will both avoid turning out like himself and also avoid sleeping with his stepdaughter. With a minimalist plot that's not afraid to meander and a staunch refusal to condemn or critique its cast's drug use, The Whackness will no doubt be a tough sell to some, but outstanding performances from both Kingsley and an astonishingly assured Peck make it an easy watch. I found myself finding The Whackness to be far more enjoyable than I expected, given the involvement of one Sir Ben Kingsley. I had this discussion with Drew the other night that I find it frustrating that Ben Kingsley can be so consistently dire and yet apparently at will pull a performance like this out of the hat. Scott, did you find The Whackness to be as enjoyable as I clearly did?
Yes, sadly. I did keep trying desperately to hate it for much the same reasons, and I couldn't really bring myself to bring any more against the new. I didn't quite like this obsession with 90s lingo. There's only so many times you can hear people described as dope and whatnot before getting a bit pissed off with it, but other than that, I can't really fault it. It's very film festival, for want of a better term. It's the same sort of coming-of-age drama that's sort of ten a penny amongst these kind of things. There's always at least one of this kind of film that pops up during film festivals. It was, of course, one of the big draws during the Edinburgh Film Festival, which we managed to dodge. And aside from this patina of edginess given by the drug use, the drug dealing, it's pretty standard issue, but it does manage to pull it off quite well. Again, it's Kingsley pretty much making the film in what is harsh to describe as a supporting role, really. He's at least as much of the focus as the supposed lead, Luke, and it's very convincing. He's almost there to ground and counterbalance Kingsley rather than anything else, and it almost edges into sort of Jim Carrey territory towards the end, but it manages to pull it off, and it's a very enjoyable film. I do quite like it, and well, it is in fact mad dope.
It's mad crazy, y'all. Drew, did you find it to be mad dope, or are you in the get rid of Kingsley club?
Well, not at all. As we were discussing it a couple of nights ago, I find it incredibly frustrating, as you do, that Ben Kingsley is so inconsistent, and a little consistent would go amiss. He's clearly got that ability all the time. Why doesn't he use it, given the last thing he was in was The Awful Love Guru, with a particularly dire performance in that? I just want to smack him about the head and say, act better more often, you fool. he was certainly one of the reasons I gave us a body swap at the film festival in June. That, in fact, his kiss with one of the Olsen twins was being so talked up, very much put me off when it turns out she's in it for all of 5 minutes. And I almost wish I had seen it a couple of months ago now, because it really would have been rather rewarding, and I would highly recommend it to anybody.
I too approached it bizarrely, desperately looking for a reason to not like it, and I found it absolutely impossible, despite the fact it throws, like we say, the sort of nonchalant drug use and drug dealing, which it's not that pivotal to the story, but at the same time it doesn't somehow manages to avoid feeling like it's been thrown there purely to be controversial. And yet I find myself unable to sort of condemn it as being irresponsible or morally reprehensible, because it seems to suit the story, if that sounds like it makes any kind of sense.
Yeah, well, I think more as a device, really, isn't it? It's more that's what brings these people together and what links their lives, rather than it being the focus itself.
It's purely a mechanic to sort of hold these people together, isn't it? But it somehow manages to avoid all the pitfalls that this should carry, and that it allows its characters to sort of... There's a scene toward the end where Luke and... Luke and Squires are on the beach, and having both sort of reached a nadir in their personal lives, they decide just to get smashed out of their faces on a cocktail of all the drugs known to man. And clearly, Levine has sort of managed to rein them in to almost a perfect degree, and sort of in terms of the increasingly bizarre conversation they have as they sit on the beach, which involves things like Shapiro randomly shouting, "I want a vagina." It manages to walk a very fine line, and I finished watching it and almost immediately wanted to watch it again, because I can't quite put my finger on what I enjoyed so much about the wackness, but all the sort of disparate elements all hang together quite admirably.
I would also like to mention that this film gets extra kudos, and particularly from the three of us, for having Ben Kingsley throwing water balloons out of an apartment window to try and hit people in the street below.
Not that we would ever condone activity based on bombast de agua.
No, we would never have tried that ever, but we are good little boys.
And the throwing thereof. Scott! Stepbrothers, what's that all about then?
Right, it's now reaching the point where I can't really bring myself to say too much about another Will Ferrell film. The central conceit here is that Ferrell and John C. Reilly play 30-odd-year-old sons with 7-year-old mentalities, staying with their mother and father respectively, and their lives get complicated by said mother and said father getting married, moving in with each other, and creating a combined unhappy family. They start off as being mortal enemies before warming to each other, and what follows is something like a cross between one of those insufferable Disney parent trap kind of things and a big bag of swearing and gross out humour. It's very hit and miss, but on balance the hits outweigh the misses, and as usual, if you're not already enamoured of the Ferrell school of nonsense, then this probably is going to do very little to convert you. It's very crude, it's very silly, it's certainly not the kind of film I'd put in a time capsule to show off the best of human culture, but as a disposable way to provide a few laughs for a couple of hours, it's acceptable enough. I'll be damned if I can really remember anything in it, mind you, which doesn't speak too well of it, and it's certainly several rungs below Anchorman, which was the last team-up between Ferrell and this director. I could go on, but I don't think it'd be adding much. It's a toss-up whether or not it's funnier than Get Smart, which is your other comedy choice rattling around the multiplexes. Toss a coin and see which one you're going to see.
I would default to, given that we almost forgot to include it in this podcast, it's probably not as funny as that.
I don't, on the upside, either of them, so what would I know? It does have small children being beaten up in a playground, which is clearly awesome.
Heading to Hong Kong, Scott, what is Triangle all about?
The concept behind Triangle is interesting, if nothing else. You get three of the top Hong Kong directors to essentially divvy a film into three parts, work almost in isolation from each other, and play pass the baton to each other. It sounds like something of a disaster in the making, to be frank, so it's something of a triumph to find out that it isn't a total disaster, although there are quite a few partial disasters knocking around in it. Veteran director Su Hark takes a first stretch, handling the establishing of a story and a character, which is maybe an odd choice. I'd always considered Su Hark more of a kind of action-orientated man than anything else, particularly compared to the other two that are involved in this. And there is something of a whiff of Hark throwing absolutely everything at the wall here and trying to give the other directors as many options as possible in his first stretch. He introduces a story of an antiques dealer, one of his friends, and a driver who are given a mysterious map by a mysterious stranger, which holds a location of some antiquity, which they're then forced to steal. There's also subplots going on between two local gangsters and a policeman who's sleeping with one of the lead characters' wives, and there's payoffs between other things, and frankly, the first third of it is a complete mess, and there's too many elements in this to even make a lick of sense. It's left to Ringo Lam in the second stretch to try and sort all this out into some sort of order and pick one particular direction and run with it. And he does manage this to a fairly decent degree, and it's then left to the youngster of the piece, Johnny Toe, who's been directing things like Exiled and Mad Detective. He co-directed Mad Detective, which we covered lately, and he's left to kind of tie everything else up in a suitable way with some quite silly Mexican standoffs and chase scenes, and it's a bit of a mess all the way throughout, to be honest. And it gets progressively less messy towards the end of the film, but there's still a fair degree of mess running all the way throughout it, which kind of ruins it a little bit. It's well below the quality of film you'd expect from any one of these directors taken in isolation. When I first heard this about this film, I assumed that there were some sort of meetings between staff, and it would just be handled in a slightly more logical way than simply chopping it into three pieces and never the three meet. And so it's something of a relief to find out that it does turn out to be a watchable film at the end of it. However, it's quite clear where the joins are, and it's quite clear that it's a mess all the way through, that's never entirely sure of where it should be going at any one particular point in time. It's not a bad film by any stretch, but it did struggle to hold my attention, and it is a little bit too convoluted for its own good. It's okay, but to be honest, I'd far recommend, if you've got the time, seeking out some of the better films that each of these directors have done individually, rather than try and watch this as a kind of introduction to them. It's one for the completest only, I would say.
The reason I might be interested in watching Triangle is because it stars my favourite Hong Kong actor, Simon Yam. And I want to know if in this film he pulls a face anywhere near half as good as in Full Time Killer. Drew, does my man Simon Yam pull any crazy faces?
No.
Oh.
That's about the size
next
of it.
Next week on the podcast.
The only person that pulls any odd faces is the crazy guy with his stereo and enormous extension lead who punctures people's tyres just to have business at his tyre shop.
Yes.
And his crazy bagel pills.
They are entirely to provide a couple of welcome Deus Ex Machinas at the end of it, and some more farcical things with getting bags mixed up at the end. It's a very silly ending.
Halfway through the third act. What will work here? A pass the parcel based farce. It had nothing to do with anything that had gone before at all, or anything that followed it for that matter. It dropped right in the middle there. It's a terrible mess.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of that. There's the middle stretch brings out all sorts of themes that just weren't present at all in the first part, and it's quite clear that this is the work of three different people throwing together at the last minute, and it's a bit of a mess all the way throughout.
So interesting as an experiment, perhaps, but a failure as a film, as a coherent one.
Indeed.
No doubt the sort of thing that fans of Hong Kong cinema will find themselves watching then, purely out of necessity, if nothing else.
Yes, but it's not going to get an awful lot out of it.
Never mind. It does have passed the parcel. I guess that makes Whackness film of the podcast then. I'd certainly recommend you check it out. Are we concurrent?
I think there's perhaps one thing I should mention. Should have really been in the last podcast, but you may still find Summerstown on general release, which, if you've not seen it, immediately go and see it, because it is clearly the best film you'll perhaps see this year.
It's certainly up there.
Yes, other than that, the Whackness is certainly one to go for.
Wicked stuff. Well, we've tried to keep it short and sweet this week, guys. Who knows in what direction we'll head in our next podcast. But until then, I've been Craig Eastman, and as always in Edinburgh, Scott was Scott.
I call it Glasgow these days, but goodbye.
Don't I feel like the asshole? And in Brighton's, Drew was Drew.
As always, and goodbye.
Fare thee well, travellers of the celluloid. We will speak to you again soon.
Hello? Hello?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Hello?
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 Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Can both of you hear me?
I can also hear myself twice.
I can also hear myself twice.
I can hear you four times.
I can hear you four times. And myself, great. And myself, great.
Oh, Craig started a cascade.
Skype has epic failed.
Oh, I'm hanging up on this before my head explodes.